mouth.
Word of 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 mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Never mind the what doesn't kill you makes you stronger sentiments of motivational plaques and pop songs. Rejection bites. Anybody who's been cast aside by an early love or passed over by an employer may find some comfort in learning that the Diary of Anne Frank was rejected by 16 publishing houses, including an editor at Knopf who panned it as a dreary record of typical family bickering, petty annoyances, and adolescent emotions. Also dismissed were George Orwell's Animal Farm and manuscripts by Jack Kerouac, Sylvia Plath, and in an infamously mocking rejection letter, Gertrude Stein. Jeff Schatz is executive editor at Grey Wolf Press, where he writes his fair share of rejection letters, and he's with us to talk about an essay he wrote on the art of rejection, an art he does not recommend to others. Jeff, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, here's the cold math that you tallied. Grey Wolf accepts under one-third of 1% of submissions. You must have written a lot of rejection letters.
As I say in the piece, I have done some terrible math, and some of it is exactly what you've quoted. Another statistic is I believe I've probably written at least 2,000 rejection letters in 15 years of publishing.
Oh, that's hard to hear.
It's hard to write.
Well, when you became an editor, what kind of advice did you receive about writing rejection letters?
Not very much. And I think that's part of the reason I wanted to write the piece is there needs to be a culture, and this goes for publishing houses or grant makers or contests, where there is some way that we impart this knowledge to those who are learning the art, in this case, the art of rejection or the art of publishing. We publish about 30 to 35 books a year. So it's those odds are stacked against writers, and I know that it's very hard for writers to hear those numbers. I wanted to, in my piece to turn the tables and sort of show that those numbers are also stacked against the person who has to do the rejecting part of it.
That kind of volume requires a form letter.
It requires a form letter. It requires many editors keep a sort of template letter that they can fill out relatively quickly, in part because of the volume, but in part because psychologically and spiritually, it's hard to spend a lot of time turning someone down. It's excruciating.
It must be very difficult. But you also write in your essay about being nice, especially when compared to some of the more scathing rejection letters on record. We mentioned Gertrude Stein's. Apparently, Alfred Knopf wrote to historian John Hope Franklin, "We feel that you've completely missed your chance to write a colorful and dramatic book." Snap! I mean, that's got to hurt. How do you soften the blow?
I think by being empathetic, by putting yourself in the position of the writer, and realizing that you're in a position where what you say matters to that person, and sometimes a great deal. So I think even simple things, using the author's name, that sounds like a simple thing, but most of those form letters, and understandably with that volume, start, "Dear author."
I guess they know what the message is going to be after that.
Yeah, you don't even have to read after a salutation like that, right? I mean, it's an already understood in the framework of a rejection letter that "Dear author," nothing good can follow that. Use the author's name and use your own name when you sign off. The more human this back and forth, this conversation, and I think it is a conversation, the more human that can be, I think the more empathetic the whole possibility of the writer-editor relationship can be from the start. I think so many writers have a sense of the editor being a sort of adversary, a sort of gatekeeper, an obstacle, in the way of their genius. And sometimes that's true. I mean, those scathing rejection letters you mentioned, I mean, they can be incredibly crushing. especially to someone who has spent, in many cases, years or decades producing, you know, a novel or a play or a book of poetry or a translation, you know, any of those works that take a lifetime of learning to really produce, and then to have it so cursorily dismissed, that's crushing.
Well, do you have that sense that you are determining somebody's fate when you're writing this back? Which can cut both ways, let's face it, Jeff. You know, a lot of pieces of literature that are submitted and get rejected for very good reasons. And maybe people should not be trying to make their career out of writing.
Well, that's true, but that's not for me to say. I mean, only the author can make that decision, whether to keep writing or to stop writing. I often tell writers that the truth is you'll probably be able to wallpaper your entire bathroom with rejection letters. And that's part of the deal. And really at any level, I've certainly heard magazine editors mention to me they've turned down Nobel Prize winners before.
Has that ever happened to you? We read about, you know, these rejection letters of famous authors. Did you ever let someone slide and think, oh, God, I really regret that?
Oh, of course. Of course. I mean, every editor, there are those books that come to you, you know, in a submission form, or maybe they come from the agent or come directly from the author, where that work is in a really early form. And you can't always make the call. And literary history will always prove you wrong. You know, we don't know yet. It's the kind of amazing thing about literary history and the way that time and special collections and archives work in this industry is all of those things will prove us all wrong. The editor wants to be known for, of course, selecting, you know, this writer and this writer and this Pulitzer Prize winner and this National Book Award winner. And sometimes that happens. History often shows, I mean, as you did with, you know, talking about The Historian and talking about Anne Frank and Nabokov and others who were turned down many, many times. I mean, we can now go back into those archives and sort of laugh. You know, we laugh a little bit when we see that horrible letter from Arthur Fifield to Gertrude Stein. That is one of the most sort of, you know, mocking her style back to her, which I think is one of the most biting rejection letters I've ever read. But in the end, I mean, the joke of history is on him. That said, I'm glad to say that at least so far, I have not turned down any Nobel Prize winners.
Okay, we're going to ask if you'd be willing to name names.
I, you know, a good editor should not name names, but part of it is, I mean, you know, you turn something down. You know, I mentioned, you know, something comes to you in maybe an early form. Let's say 2 years later, you see that book being picked up by another press. And it's, you know, and it's totally transformed and it's different and it's better. And maybe you would have made a different decision if the manuscript would have come to you like that. But it means that editor at that other publishing house saw something that you didn't see. And this is why, rather than competing with each other, I think we're all in the same collective enterprise of bringing forward the art of literature. And that's really important, to have those colleague presses, not as adversaries or competitors, though, I mean, of course, that's there in the background.
Well, how about you? I mean, you are a person who's in the business of publishing, but also of rejecting people. How do you typically respond to rejection? I mean, are you analyzing the form of the letter and noting that your name would be named? Or were you just thinking about the message? Oh, they don't like me. They don't want me.
I think the message hits first. I mean, how can it not? I want to try to even give a sentence that says why we made this decision. You know, and it can be, it's very hard to do. It's very hard to put your finger on something to tell someone why you turned them down. But I hope that says to the writer, maybe not on that first reading, but on that second reading, that might be helpful to them or helps them at least understand from Grey Wolf Press, just one publisher of many, why we made the decision we did. I hope that's helpful. And I hope that's more helpful than just saying, no, your work is not wanted at this time.
Jeff Schatz, executive editor at Grey Wolf Press. Thank you so much for, staying with us.
Thank you. I hope your listeners don't mind hearing about rejection.
Well, you know, everybody has to live with it. It's good to hear it on the other side. You can read Jeff's essay on the art of rejection, including some of the revenge responses that we could not share on radio that are really worth looking at. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Jeff Schatz included several notable rejection letters in his essay to remind all of us that the old gatekeepers did not always get it right. We decided to turn a few notable examples into dramatic readings. During our conversation, Jeff mentioned one of the most famously cutting rejection letters ever penned. Gertrude Stein is now well known for her use of repetition as a rhetorical device. But when she submitted the manuscript for Three Lives to a London publisher, she was a relative unknown and got this mocking response.
A letter to Miss Gertrude Stein from Arthur C. Fifield, publisher. April 19th, 1912. Dear Madam, I am only one, only one, only one. Not two, not three, only one. Only one life to live. Only 60 minutes in 1 hour. Only one pair of eyes, only one brain, only one being. Being only one, having only one pair of eyes, having only one time, having only one life, I cannot read your manuscript three or four times. Not even one time. Only one look is enough. Hardly one copy would sell here. Hardly one, hardly one. Many thanks. I am returning the manuscript by registered post. Only one manuscript by one post. Sincerely, Arthur C. Fifield, publisher.
Getting a personalized rejection letter is pretty rare. More often, publishers, record companies, and movie houses rely on carefully worded form letters, like this one from Sub Pop, the record label that signed Nirvana. The letterhead reads, "From Sub Pop, celebrating several years of record making.
Dear Loser, thank you for sending your demo materials to Sub Pop for consideration. Presently, your demo package is one of a massive quantity of commendable material we receive every day at Sub Pop World Headquarters, and, due to time and volume restrictions, is on its way through the great lower intestine that is the talent acquisition process. We appreciate your interest in Sub Pop and wish you the best in your pursuit. Kind regards." Footnote: this is a form letter. This letter is what is known as a rejection letter.
Gold teeth and a curse for this town. They're all in my mouth. Only I don't know how.
What we're listening to are rejection letters that have been written to people who we now consider pioneers in their respective fields. Now just imagine the mortification Alfred H. Barr, director of museum collections at the Museum of Modern Art, must have felt when he recalled declining the gift of a drawing from one Andy Warhol.
Dear Mr. Warhol, last week, our committee on the museum collections held its first meeting of the fall season and had a chance to study your drawing entitled Shoe, which you so generously offered as a gift to the museum. I regret that I must report to you that the committee decided, after careful consideration, that they ought not to accept it for our collection. Sincerely, Alfred H. Barr, Jr., Director of Museum Collections. P.S. The drawing may be picked up from the museum at your convenience.
Ain't got nothing at all.
Sometimes being dismissed has nothing to do with the actual talent of the person applying. This apparent form letter from Disney Studios was written back in 1938 to an aspiring artist who was rejected on the basis of her sex.
Dear Miss Ford, your letter of recent date has been received in the inking and painting department for reply. Women do not do any of the creative work in connection with preparing the cartoons for the screen, as that work is performed entirely by young men. The only work open to women consists of tracing the characters on clear celluloid sheets with India ink and filling in the tracings on the reverse side with paint, according to the directions. It would not be advisable to come to Hollywood with the above specifically in view, as there are really very few openings in comparison with the number of girls who apply. Yours, very truly, Mary Cleave, Walt Disney Productions Limited.
Just want to show you what I thought of you.
Oh, that's what you think of me. Oh, Mama, I think you're smart, don't you? Here.
Oh, Mama, I'm
And that was Word of Mouth's small selection of dramatic readings of real rejection letters. You can find even more letters, including one from an editor who passed on the Diary of Anne Frank, calling it, quote, dull. It's on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott.
There was always a baron of beef or a shoulder or leg of lamb before my father.
That's from an opening scene of the film How Green Was My Valley, which won the Academy Award for Best Picture in 1941. That same year, another little film was snubbed from the red carpet.
Rosebud.
Orson Welles' Citizen Kane. Enraged at the title character's obvious likeness to himself, newspaper magnate William Randolph Hearst did everything in his power to destroy Citizen Kane. Although he could not prevent its release, he was able to squash its success at the box office and foil its chances for Best Picture. Hearst's attack was the first and perhaps most aggressive smear campaign in the Academy Awards' 86-year history, but there have been plenty more since. Here with a few is Marlo Stern, entertainment editor at the Daily Beast. Hello, Marlo.
Hey, Virginia. How's it going?
Very well. Some really dirty stuff here. Funny that some of these smear campaigns do get remembered long after the ceremony, as in the case of Good Will Hunting back in 1998. What was the smear then?
Right. So this was a Harvey Weinstein film, so he wasn't behind it. But the smear was that William Goldman, writer of All the President's Men, had written it, but then he later confessed that he didn't. And then after that, Variety ran a story insinuating that Ted Talley, writer of Silence of the Lambs, wrote the screenplay, which, again, turned out to be a completely ridiculous claim. And I think just a lot of people had a hard time wrapping their head around the fact that these two boys from Boston, Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, with dimples, could churn out such a good screenplay.
Well, and I say that they get remembered because we were sitting around when we were talking about this thinking, wait, did they actually write this? You know, so these kind of things carry over. In general, who orchestrates them? The studios or competing nominees?
It's a mixture of both, but I think it's usually the competing nominees. I mean, Matt Damon later told the New York Times that the Ted Talley stuff all came from the, quote, As Good As It Gets camp, which was the other nominee that year for Best Original Screenplay, was James Brooks. But obviously, he said the filmmaker had nothing to do with that. It was these, perhaps the publicists that the film had hired for their Oscar campaign.
Do you like apples?
Yeah.
Well, I got a number. How do you like them apples?
Well, the year after that, 1999, another smear against Saving Private Ryan. What happened?
Right. In 1999, the two big Best Picture contenders were Saving Private Ryan, Steven Spielberg's big World War II epic, and Shakespeare in Love, which was a comparatively smaller film. And the first thing that happened was that Harvey Weinstein spent an enormous amount of money promoting Shakespeare in Love during Oscar season, something like $5 to $10 million on the Oscar campaign, which was unheard of at the time. It was usually studios, especially small studios like Miramax, would only spend around $1 million for their Oscar campaign. But he spent $5 to $10 million and really raised the bar as far as Oscar spending goes for ads. But the thing that really probably hurt Saving Private Ryan's chances the most were all these stories that came out in the press that said that the British were, quote, riled by Ryan, and that a group of British World War II veterans felt slighted by Spielberg's film because during the Omaha Beach sequence, which is the most riveting scene in the film, the C Company of the U.S. Rangers 2nd Battalion is seen being dispatched by U.S. ships, when in actuality, the British Royal Navy dispatched them to Omaha Beach. So a bunch of stories started surfacing in the press saying that surviving British members of the Royal Navy were pissed off that they weren't included in the film.
Well, the Weinstein brothers come up again. Shakespeare in Love did take the Oscar for Best Picture back in 1999. They obviously didn't invent the dirty politics, but how much gets tied back to them?
You know, they definitely changed the game. I mean, during the year that Gangs of New York was up for a bunch of Oscars, including Best Picture, and it was really Martin Scorsese's comeback They even took out ads that said that Robert Wise, the director of Sound of Music, praised Gangs in New York and said it should win Best Picture, when it came out that not only had Robert Wise not penned this open letter praising Gangs in New York, it was penned by a Miramax publicist, and Robert Wise just signed it. And so the Academy had to develop new rules. So now you can't really get former Academy members to publicly endorse nominees.
Well, how about put down a film? Because in 2006, it was a couple of esteemed actors that helped scupper the chances for Brokeback Mountain. Tell us the story behind that.
This is one of the more bizarre smear campaigns waged during Oscar season. In 2006, it was Crash, Paul Haggis's racial relations drama, versus Ang Lee's Brokeback Mountain, this beautiful cowboy love story. Two veteran actors, Tony Curtis and Ernest Borgnine, took it upon themselves to violently campaign against Brokeback Mountain out of nowhere, it seems. They didn't even see the movie. They appeared on Fox News saying some homophobic remarks. And it was most surprising coming from Tony Curtis, because he had starred in Some Like It Hot, which is, you know, one of the biggest...
cross-dressing comedies?
Quote-unquote gay films. Yeah, cross-dressing comedies of all time. And it ended up hurting Brokeback Mountain, and it lost to Crash for Best Picture. The other thing that happened, though, was that the producers of Crash also sent out 130,000 Oscar screeners to virtually every member of the Screen Actors Guild and the Academy,
which
was also unprecedented.
Tell you what, we could have had a good life together, had us a place of our own. But you didn't want it, Ennis. So what we got now is Brokeback Mountain.
Well, we have two interesting, almost side-by-side examples of The Hurt Locker in 2010, Kathryn Bigelow's film, when she was up against her ex-husband, James Cameron, who produced the multi-million-dollar film Avatar. And then just a couple of years later, her film Zero Dark Thirty about the bin Laden raid. If you could just tell us a little bit about the politics or the inner politicking of those campaigns, how they played out differently, and why you think they did.
Sure. They both involved Kathryn Bigelow films, but they were very different smear campaigns. I mean, the first example, 2010's The Hurt Locker, when it was up for Best Picture versus Avatar, which obviously made close to $3 billion, whereas The Hurt Locker had only grossed, you know, less than $50 million worldwide, and I think under $20 million in the U.S., becoming, I believe, the lowest grossing Best Picture winner ever, although... you'll have to check my fact work on that. But all these stories seem to come out around the time of The Hurt Locker, of ex-bomb disposal experts questioning its authenticity, claiming that it didn't depict combat accurately. And also the producer of The Hurt Locker, or one of the producers on The Hurt Locker, Nicholas Chartier, came out and wrote this mass email to all his friends and fellow Oscar voters asking him to vote for his film over a, quote, $500 million film, saying that, you know, voting for Hill's film would be beneficial to the independent film industry, while if you vote for Avatar, you're basically just patting Hollywood on the back. So all these things started to come out around the release of Hurt Locker. Thankfully, The Hurt Locker wasn't affected by it and went on to win six Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director for Kathryn Bigelow, making her the first woman ever to win the award. Now, the case of Zero Dark Thirty is a little different. I mean, with Zero Dark Thirty, from the word go, it was under attack by every op-ed writer, it seemed, saying that it promoted torture. Frank Bruni, the New York Times columnist, penned this crazy op-ed with the opening line, "I'm betting that Dick Cheney will love the new movie Do Zero Dark Thirty."
Mm-hmm.
And Bigelow and screenwriter and her partner at the time, Mark Bull, who was an ex-journalist himself, claimed the contrary and, you know, wrote their own op-eds and came out in defense of the film. But still, it caused a lot of controversy. And the film, even though it had, you know, it was the most critically acclaimed film of the year, it had the highest Metacritic score of any film that year, it only managed to win one Oscar for Best Sound Editing when all was said and done.
We have two big scandals going on during this Oscar season. One, Woody Allen, his film Blue Jasmine, is up for an award. He's mired in allegations of sexual abuse of his daughter and his defense of that. The other movie that seems to be in the crosshairs is The Wolf of Wall Street, Martin Scorsese's film about the, let's say, exuberant excesses of Wall Street.
Right. It seems that from the time it was released, The Wolf of Wall Street has been under fire by a lot of people for basically being a celebration of this shady stockbroker played by Leonardo DiCaprio. And since it's based on a memoir, Jordan Belfort's memoir of the same name, and features DiCaprio, who is this attractive movie star, playing the shady stockbroker and doing, scamming all these people through various pump and dump schemes and living this jet set lifestyle, they think that he's going to be this generation's Gordon Gekko, basically, because, and I don't think it really does promote this viewpoint, and it doesn't really glamorize it. Some people will get that impression from it.
Let me tell you something. There is no nobility in poverty. I have been a rich man, and I have been a poor man, and I choose rich every time.
Two of the films that are targeted this year by campaigns, Wolf of Wall Street and Blue Jasmine, they're both underdogs for Best Picture as it is. Now, why not spend all the time and money orchestrating a better campaign against American Hustle or 12 Years a Slave, which are actually favored this Oscar season?
I don't know. You know, I just think that it makes a better story. I mean, it's tough to attack something like 12 Years a Slave for a number of reasons.
A share of attacks for being torture porn, hasn't it?
Right, right. But most of those attacks have been from legitimate crazy people like Armand White, the film critic that recently got booted from the New York Film Critics Circle. But Wolf of Wall Street in particular, I think it's just an easier target for people. And it deals with issues that trouble a lot of people today, which are that, you know, the fat cats on Wall Street have essentially gotten away with it and keep getting away with it. And so when you have this film that glamorizes this, or that people think are glamorizing this, then it can be troubling for the public.
Marlo, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
Marlo Stern, entertainment editor at The Daily Beast. To find a link to read more about the recent Oscar smear campaigns, that's at wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, we're going to celebrate the best of the worst of 2013 with the irrepressibly snarky founder of the Razzie Awards.
Word of mouth.
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 What?
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. What do Christian Bale, Chiwetel Ejiofor, and Jaden Smith all have in common? They're all being recognized this weekend for creating some of the year's most memorable on-screen performances. Bale and Ejiofor are top contenders for Best Actor at Sunday's 86th Annual Academy Awards. Jaden Smith, not so much.
What was your mistake? Trusting me? Depending on me, thinking that I could do this?
Now I'm giving you an order.
You wouldn't give any other ranger that order. I'm not a coward.
Father-son duo Will and Jaden Smith there in a clip from M. Night Shyamalan's latest flop, After Earth, which racked up a total of 6 nominations at the 34th annual Razzie Awards, or Golden Raspberry Awards. Unlike the Oscars, the Razzies are celebrating the year's worst films, the most pathetic performances, and cringeworthy screenplays. That's on Saturday night. John Wilson is creator and head Raspberry and joins us now with more on this year's nominees. Great to have you back with us, John.
Great to be with you. I find it amusing that the dialogue you just played accidentally references one of the competitors of After Earth for Worst Picture, The Lone Ranger.
Oh, well, you know, they're all, you can reel
they're
them all in.
They're all of a piece, yes. Birds of a feather, as it were.
You know, M. Night Shyamalan has not had such a good record since hitting it big with The Sixth Sense. What made his latest such a stinker, do you think?
Well, let me offer you a mnemonic to remember how to pronounce his name. I always think in my head, Shyamalan's a ding-dong. there's a rumor in the business, and I should say it is just a rumor, that Will Smith, who was behind this movie and is the father of Jaden Smith, as you mentioned, hired Shyamalan because he thought Shyamalan would be so intimidated by Will Smith's power and success that he would let Smith direct it. And if it didn't turn out well, Will Smith wouldn't be blamed. And We actually have a picture we're using in the ceremony where Shyamalan is standing next to the camera looking a little dejected, and right next to him, also behind the camera, is Will Smith gesticulating wildly, apparently teaching his son to overact. The sad thing here is Jaden Smith actually had a career going. He did a remake of The Karate Kid that did quite well a couple of years ago, and Mom and Dad stepped in with this great big sci-fi project that Dad co-starred in and just stomped on the momentum that he had going.
Well, this is going to be the subject of therapy many years from now in some Los Angeles expensive therapist's office. But let's go to the Canyons. Only one nomination for Lindsay Lohan as Worst Actress. Now, it sounds like the Canyons got snubbed by the Razzies.
She's kind of a perennial with us. We call people like that Razzie repeat offenders. And her movie was released in such a way that by Academy rules, which we tend to follow, it's part of the parody that we're doing, under Academy rules, her film would not have been eligible, but we looked at it and said, it's Lindsay Lohan. You kind of have to give her creds. And it's a picture that the man who wrote and directed it has done some pretty serious stuff in the past. He's a screenwriter of Taxi Driver. But it's another one of those things where she's not really investing a whole lot in the character or the story, or, you know, she's Lindsay Lohan, what can I say? I think it's rather sad because she had such potential to do something with the talent she had, and now she's a Razzie nominee again.
I figured I have to find him attractive on some level. You cast him as the lead in the movie.
No, that's not true. I did not cast him in the movie.
You made me cast him as the lead of the movie.
No, we've been over this. I didn't make you do anything. You hired him as a favor to Gina, and that's why he's in the movie, isn't it?
Okay, it ain't no Taxi Driver. I guess that's all we can say. A first-time nod for the A-list actor and former Oscar nominee, Johnny Depp. He is up for Worst Actor for his role in The Lone Ranger.
He plays Tonto, which is a character it's almost impossible not to be offensive doing these days. The way that he dealt with it is he smeared bird poop all over his face, ran black lines down his cheeks, put a dead crow on his head, you know, Jay Silverheels, as Tonto 60 years ago, was no less offensive than Johnny Depp is in 2013. And it's the kind of thing, one of the devices we use in our show, we find funny but actual nasty critics quotes. More than one critic compared this decision to do this movie to John Travolta doing Battlefield Earth. So
a perennial Razzie favorite. Here's just a clip from The Lone Ranger.
Eyes cut by the bullets that killed him. From the great beyond, he will protect you and the ones you love.
You want me to wear a mask?
The men you seek think you are dead, Kemosabe. Better to stay that way.
Now, do you think Johnny Depp may have gotten a boost in the voting for Worst Actor when he blamed critics for The Lone Ranger's poor showing in the box office?
Yes, that was not a smart move. And they did it when the film was released in Europe. It didn't really impact the grosses here, which were rather pitiful. As we are pointing out in our ceremony, the executives at Walt Disney Pictures had to admit to their shareholders that that movie lost $200 million.
Wowie.
You just don't see why they bothered to remake this thing. And all along, the Disney executives who wanted to have this happen were told, no one knows this character anymore. No, it hasn't. The show has not been on TV for 40 years. The characters are forgotten. There's no, you know, other than Johnny Depp, you don't have a reason for anyone to want to see this. And then when Johnny Depp gives the performance he gave, then you've got no reason for anyone to go see this.
Before the Oscars this weekend will be the Golden Raspberries on Saturday night. We're speaking with John Wilson, creator and head Raspberry, honoring the worst movie performances, the worst films, and the worst scripts for this year. Of all the nominees, Movie 43 has the worst rating from critics and audiences. Now, this is according to Rotten Tomatoes.
Yes.
Do you think that those aggregated reviews are a good indicator of what might happen at the Razzies?
We actually have an ongoing relationship with Rotten Tomatoes because we rely on them as one of our three major indicators. the three main things that we look at in trying to decide what the logical contender are: critical response, and as you just said, movie 43, I think it was 96% negative. We look at box office versus budget. What did it cost? How much was lost? And clearly the leader there would be Lone Ranger. And then we also look at what I call Razzie pedigree, which was, we were discussing with Lindsay Lohan. Does this person or do the makers of this film have a history with us? One of our stalwarts from the early years, Sylvester Stallone, is back for the first time in, I think, a decade, because he had three bad movies in 1 year. But yeah, we do look at the Rotten Tomatoes, tomato meter is what they call it. And anything that gets below 50% will at least, you know, take a short look at. Anything that gets below 25 is probably going to make the nominating ballot. Anything that gets below 10 is likely to be end up on the ballot at least somewhere.
And what do they get?
I just made six of them in my ex-wife's backyard on Sunday afternoon. They are handcrafted. It kind of looks like a Grammy Award. It's a bunch of film pieces put together, a film, 35-millimeter film core, a Super 8 film reel, and then a handcrafted raspberry stuck atop a pedestal and all spray-painted lovely gold. We like to say that the street value of it is about $4.97, which is an accurate reflection of the street value of most of the nominees.
Let's hear just a clip from movie 43 with A-lister.
Oh, do we have to?
Well, you know, block your ears. Here's Naomi Watts.
Written assignments are to be done in black ink. When are you going to get that through your thick skull, Mr. Morris?
Miller.
That's a detention.
Naomi Watts there from movie 43. I mean, this was a star-studded cast. I wonder if we as an audience are even more amazed when a celebrated actor has a terrible, terrible performance.
Well, it's, this particular film took years to complete, and I would argue perhaps it's never was completed. But it's a whole bunch of short little pieces that are glued together, and there's sort of a running backstory that Dennis Quaid is pitching an awful script to a studio executive. But it is amazing when you look at all the names that are in it. I mean, Halle Berry and Hugh Jackman, and as you just played, Naomi Watts, and Kate Winslet. And I mean, it's just an amazing number of names, all of whom you would presume know better than to do something like this. The man who was essentially behind the whole thing and directed a couple of the segments is one of the Farrelly brothers, the guys who about 20 years ago did Dumb and Dumber, which I will admit it's a stupid movie, but I did think it was funny.
And Something About Mary.
Yeah. And so that credential convinced all of these people, well, this is the guy who did that. Maybe he knows better than I do. And among the more astounding moments in it are the Halle Berry sequence. She's challenged by, it's a game of truth or dare at a restaurant. She's challenged to mash a bowl of guacamole with her breast. And she has a prosthetic breast about the size of a basketball. And you just keep going, what? You're an Oscar winner. You're a Razzie winner too, but you're an Academy Award winner. What are you doing?
Well, do you think any of these movies are worth watching for sheer entertainment value? Can a movie be so bad that it's good? It can almost take on a kind of camp cult status.
Those are the ones that I love. And the touchstones from that league would be Showgirls, which is the most amazingly tasteless movie ever made. The review on that one said, at last, someone has made a movie about Las Vegas that's more tasteless than Las Vegas. Unfortunately, I don't think we have a so bad it's fun movie this year. Most of what we have, After Earth is so bad that one of our members said they saw it on an airplane and they were actually thinking about walking out.
Well, all right. So After Earth, poor M. Night Shyamalan. Thank you for the mnemonic reminder, by the way. But do you ever feel badly? I mean, if you ever ran into this guy, would you feel badly about sort of raspberrying him over and over again?
He's pretty consistent delivering Drek since the turning point for him was when he had a script called Lady in the Water, which won him, I think, two or three Razzies and got him nominated for several. And he has essentially, I mean, look at what he's done since. The Last Airbender, which to me sounds like somebody who can flatulate around corners. The Happening, where trees and bushes are trying to kill humans by, I don't even know what logic there was to that. And now After Earth, the man is definitely on the skids. And if you, I think, as objectively as I can look at it, he certainly has played a role in putting himself there. It's not like somebody did it to him.
All right, John Wilson. So what does he get from John Wilson, head Razzie?
Ah, you're looking for one of these. Here we go. Back off from the mic. I don't want to get you splattered.
John Wilson, founder of the Razzies, head Raspberry. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Golden Raspberry or Razzie Awards are celebrating Hollywood's worst this Saturday. More information at wordofmouthradio.org. Heard about some of the worst films of 2013. Now to a story from an unabashed fan of B-movies, Dana Gould. In addition to being a stand-up comedian and television actor, Gould was also a longtime writer and producer on The Simpsons, where his love of B-films and science fiction often crept into his writing. Here he shares a story from his podcast, The Dana Gould Hour, about a science fiction film from 1971 that broke ground. Not for special effects, but for featuring one of the first interracial kisses in celluloid history.
If you're talking about surviving the apocalypse, or any situation that is, shall we say, apocalypse adjacent, then you've got to talk about the Omega Man. The 1971 Charlton Heston Last Man on Earth sci-fi classic. Based on a novel by the great Richard Matheson called I Am Legend. Sound familiar? It was written in 1954 and tells the story of a plague of vampirism that wipes out all of humanity except for poor Robert Neville, who has to deal. I Am Legend is an excellent book. Such a great fun read. Actually, Stephen King cites it as a major influence, and really easy to see why. Highly recommend. From the Gould book bag to you, I Am Legend. Before it was made into the Omega Man, it was made into the 1964 Vincent Price schlocker The Last Man on Earth, which Richard Matheson actually wrote, but he didn't like the way it came out, so he changed his name in the credits to Logan Swanson, which I think sounds vaguely porny. Maybe that's just me. I really like The Last Man on Earth. It looks a lot like Night of the Living Dead, but it predated that film by 4 years. The only problem with the film is that Vincent Price is the hero. He's the regular Joe that you're supposed to relate to, and that never quite comes off.
December 1965. Is that all it has been since I inherited the world? Only 3 years. It seems like 100 million.
Eventually, he meets a woman, but it turns out she is not all that she seems. Ain't that always the way? There's one really good part of the film at the very end where Vincent Price, facing down his army of attackers, gets off one great Vincent Price line.
You freaks! All of you. All of you freaks! I'm a man. The last.
The film did not do a ton of business. In fact, when The Omega Man went into pre-production, only 7 years later, the producers had never even heard of it. But I guess the guy who owned the rights informed them. I guess they struck a deal. In Charlton Heston's book, The Actor's Life, which are his printed journals, his quote is, "Screen The Last Man on Earth today at Warner's. Nothing against Vinny, but it's not that much." My favorite scene in The Omega Man is right at the very beginning when Heston, standing alone in a big intersection in downtown Los Angeles, imagines that all the payphones start ringing.
There is no phone ringing, damn it!
There is no phone.
Nice and creepy. The vampires from I Am Legend have now become a band of technology-hating albino pyromaniacs, thus dispensing with the crosses and stakes and allowing Charlton to handle things in a more Hestonian manner. Something else is very different in The Omega Man from the other movie and from the book. The early 1970s was the heyday of blaxploitation cinema.
Up yours! Get out of the way!
Shaft's his name. Shaft's his game.
When Foxy Brown comes to town, all the brothers gather round. 'Cause she can really shake 'em down.
Foxy lady, Foxy lady.
And the producers of The Omega Man thought, wow, those blaxploitation films are making a lot of money. I'd like to make some of that money, too. And so, The Omega Man became the first post-apocalyptic blaxploitation kinda zombie movie.
And yet the whole family can't bring him down out of that
hunky paradise, brother.
Forget the old ways, brother. All the old hatreds, all the old pains. Forget and remember, the family is one.
And then there's Rosalind Cash, the female lead in the film. Off-screen, supposedly, she was somewhat intimidated by acting against Charlton Heston, who was, after all, Moses. But on-screen, she has no trouble at all.
Don't turn and just stand. When I want you to turn, I'll turn you on or off, up or around. I'll turn you. Now, cool it.
My name's Robert.
Your name's Mud.
But they became friends.
You're sweet. It's okay, Tommy. This is the man, and I mean the man. But he's cool. It's okay.
Friends who kiss on the lips.
Now, what you thinking?
Well, you know the old song? If you were the only girl in the world and I were the only boy, okay. But till then, don't bother me. I guess I'm the only boy. You know, it's been a long, long time. I'm not sure I remember how this goes.
The Omega Man has one of the first interracial love scenes in a major motion picture. And it happened because Charlton Heston, right-wing, arch-conservative Charlton Heston, made it happen. I have to say, from a first-hand perspective, I did Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect, the show that he had on ABC before the HBO series. I did it with Charlton Heston back in the late 1990s, and I have to tell you, although we disagreed on just about everything, he could not have been a nicer guy. After the show, I told him how much I loved Planet of the Apes, and I'll never forget it. I said, you know, this might sound dorky, but when I was a kid, Planet of the Apes meant as much to me as baseball means to most kids. And I'll never forget it. He put both hands on my shoulders and he said, "This might be dorky too, but I'd be happy to send you a photo from the film if you'd like." And I wrote down my address and I handed it to him and he put it in his pocket and 4 days later showed up in the mail. And it is framed on my wall to this day and I still have the envelope. That is not the end of the Omega Man story. It was remade again in 2007 with Will Smith under the original title, I Am Legend, and I am willing to bet that the entire budget of The Omega Man probably came close to the latte budget on I Am Legend. But The Omega Man is the one that I love. One last little tidbit, and this is a spoiler alert if you've never seen the film. The fountain at the very end of the movie, into which Charlton Heston bleeds to death, is the very same fountain at the beginning of Friends. Both shot on the Warner Brothers Ranch in beautiful downtown Burbank.
Dana Gould, host of the podcast The Dana Gould Hour. You can find a link to his story on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. However you choose to do it, enjoy your Oscar or anti-Oscar weekend. Happy to have you with us today. And if you do like what you heard, there is much more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us. You can send us your feedback and share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Monday at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio. Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.